Ladies and gentlemen, my name's Tim Besley, and I'm a member of the Economics Department here at the LSE, and I'm delighted to welcome you this evening to the Morishima Lecture given by Thomas Piketty and supported by the Suntory Toyota International Centers for Economics and Related Disciplines. The lecture is named in honor of the late Professor Michio Morishima, who was a member of the Economics Department and the founder of Stickard. And Thomas was telling me on the way down that when he came to LSE, it was because he wanted to work with Michio Morishima, having read his work, which is very nice to hear. Michio was an economist of enormous range, whose interests combined the higher points of economic theory and the most practical interest in the world, and much like I think our speaker this evening. And I'm particularly delighted to welcome his wife, Mrs. Yoko Morishima, to the lecture this evening. Now, one of the first things that Michio did was to recruit Sir Tony Atkinson to lead Stickard in its early years. And this provides a direct link to this evening's lecture, since Tony is probably the major figure globally in the study of economic inequality, which is the topic of tonight's lecture. It's a great pleasure to welcome Thomas Piketty. Given the number of column inches devoted to Thomas in recent weeks, it's tempting to say he needs no introduction. But something that is rarely reported is how Thomas was already an influential economist before he was propelled to stardom by his best-selling book, Capital in the 21st Century. I knew Thomas well before he was famous, and first met him shortly after he arrived at MIT, having studied at the LSE as part of our European doctoral program. At that time, Thomas was an economic theorist with particular interest in public economics, but it's for his work on the dynamics of inequality which he established himself. This work was published in top mainstream economics journals, and he was awarded the Euro Janssen Award last year, the top award given in Europe for a younger economist, and was awarded on the basis of his remarkable research. It is remarkable how Thomas' book has captured the popular imagination and created a platform for his creative research to influence the popular debate. Thomas has been described, as we know, as a rock star, but he's not the first rock star to come out of the LSE Economics Department, whose former students include, I'll remind you, Mick Jagger. Let's hope that Thomas is still enjoying the kind of adulation that Mick Jagger enjoys when he is also 70. Anyway, I'm now going to invite Thomas to the podium. He'll talk for about 45 minutes, and then we'll take questions. Could I ask you all to put your mobile phones on silent? And there's a hashtag for this event for those who would like to tweet, which is LSE Capital. Thomas, you're very welcome. Back to the LSE.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tim, for this nice introduction. I'm very, very glad to be back here at LSE. So as you can all see, these 2 years that I spent at LSE as a student were not enough to change my French accent, and I'm really sorry to be so bad at speaking your beautiful language, but anyway. So I am also bad with technique, but I'm sure there must be a way to get my slides up onto the screen. Okay, so this is what I'm going to be talking about. This presentation is going to be based on this book, Capital in the 21st Century. I should apologize also for having written such a long book. I'm sorry about that. I think this is, although it is a bit long, it is a readable book. And, I've really tried hard to write a readable story of income and wealth distribution. The reason why this is so long is also because in this book, I've tried to put together a lot of historical data on the dynamics of income and wealth distribution in over 20 countries since the 18th century. And, I should say very clearly that, this comes out of a very large international collective process of accumulation of data and collection of historical data and income and wealth. And I could never have managed to collect all this data by myself. So I started working on the history of income and wealth inequality in France about 15 years ago. And then I was very fortunate to find, first of all, Tony Atkinson, who was my teacher at LSE in 1991-92, and who was the first reader of my work on income inequality in France, and who immediately extended this work to the case of Britain, has been working on many other countries, and together we've published two large volumes in 2007-2010 at Oxford University Press, where we put together similar series on income inequality for over 20 countries. And this has involved many other researchers, Emmanuel Saez for the United States, Facundo Alvaredo for Argentina and Spain, Abhijit Banerjee for India, and Camille Landais, who is there somewhere, has worked on the case of France in much more detail than I did. Gabriel Zucman has worked with me on the history of wealth to income ratio in the case of France, and he's going to start teaching at LSE next fall. Postel Vinet Rosenthal have been collecting historical inheritance data with me. There's no way I can refer to everybody, but they are all referred to in the book and on the website, where you will find a lot more detailed information on the historical series. But let me again make clear that this is primarily a book based on this historical data collection on income and wealth. So there is a part four of the book about the future and about possible conclusions that can be drawn for the future from this historical database. But let me be very clear about the fact that, I am better at analyzing the past than the future, and that, you can draw... we are in the domain of the social sciences. You can draw different conclusions from history. And, if you disagree with everything that's in part four, this is fine with me, as long, you will find some interest in what's in part one, two, and three. And, ultimately, the objective of the book is not to tell you with certainty, what's going to happen to the future of inequality and what should be done, but rather to give everybody more information so that they can write their own part four. We still have too little data to be sure about anything. I think we have more data than we used to. We can, this can help maybe to have a more informed democratic debate, but, we know too little, and the objective of this book is simply to provide some of this historical material in an accessible form to everybody. Okay, so, in this presentation, I will present some of the results that are in the book, but, of course, there is no way I can present everything that's in the book. You can find all the graphs and series for free on this address, but I'm afraid I cannot put the PDF file for the book online for free, otherwise my publisher, who is somewhere in the room, would probably disagree. So... let me tell you a bit more about the data sources that I've been putting together. So there's really two pieces of data, one about income and one about wealth. And largely what my book is doing is to try to shift the attention from income to wealth, but of course both are important. And wealth and capital is partly the result of accumulation out of income, so the two are of course related. So let me start with the income part of the database I'm going to be using. So this comes from the World Top Income Database. So initially, the countries in red are the countries that are in the database. The countries in blue are about to enter the database. So what being in the database means is that we've collected the longest possible historical data on income. So this generally comes from the income tax. So the modern income tax was created in 1913 in the United States, in 1914 in France. 1909 in Britain, the income tax was made progressive, but there had been an income tax starting in the 1840s. There was an income tax that was created in India in 1922. There were progressive income tax in Germany, in Sweden, in a number of Nordic countries or in Japan starting around 1880, 1890. But by and large, you know, this is between 1900 and 1920 that you start having an income tax, which also means that you start having data on income. Okay, so that's an important lesson, is that, you know, taxation is not only here to raise revenue. Taxation is also a way to produce legal categories and statistical categories and democratic transparency about income and wealth. You know, when you don't have an income tax, many people don't even know what their income is. And when you don't have a corporate tax, sometimes you don't even have company accounts to define what corporate profits are. So it's not that the company accounts today are particularly transparent, but at least they are there. And, you know, when there was no corporate tax, you didn't have anything. So for income tax, you know, the creation of income taxation means that we have data. Now, this data, you know, this historical data was not used in a systematic way until recently, probably because this was too historical for economists and too economic for historians. So nobody really had been extending. So the first work that has been done along these lines was published in the 1950s by Kuznets, who was an American economist, a Ukrainian-born American economist, who first computed the first national accounts of the United States, the first GDP and national income series, and then, you know, interestingly, moved to the direction of inequality measurement. So this was like the next step after, you know, the national income in the U.S. He started using the federal income tax data that started existing in 1913, and he used it between 1913 and 1948 to compute the share of top 10% income earners in total U.S. national income. And what he found was a decline in inequality, which you can see in this graph, with a big decline in the share of U.S. income going to the top 10%, you know, between the 1920s and the early 1950s. And you go from, you know, 45-50% of total income going to the top 10% income earners to 30-35%. And all what we've been doing in this work, in a way, is to extend Kuznets' methodology to more countries and longer time periods. So instead, you know, Kuznets had only one country over a 35-year period, whereas we have 20 countries over an entire century and sometimes a bit more. And as you can see with this picture for the U.S., of course, this changes quite a lot the view that we can have of the process. Kuznets came with a pretty optimistic view in the 50s and 60s, which was, you know, the idea that you have a reduction in inequality in advanced stages of development. Whereas, you know, with the new part on the right-hand side of the graph that we've added with Emmanuel Saez. So this graph on the U.S. comes from joint work with Emmanuel Saez. So we confirm what Kuznets had found for the first half of the century. You know, we are using the same data, and, you know, he didn't have Excel, but he did the computations right, and we agree with him. But all what we add is that, you know, in the second half, and in particular in the past 30 years, you have this huge increase in income inequality. So this gives a very different picture for the overall process. So, you know, in the post-war period, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, there was this very optimistic belief that, you know, inequality will naturally decline and then stabilize in advanced stages of development. And indeed, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, if you have a stable share going to the top, this means that everybody benefits from growth with the same growth rate. You know, you have the, if you take the aggregate growth rate of the economy, you have the same growth rate for the top 10%, the bottom 90%, the bottom 50%, so you have balanced growth paths. Now, in the past 30 years, you can see that this doesn't look like a balanced growth path because, you know, the share going to the top has increased from 30-35% to almost 50%. And in fact, the latest data point that we have put online with Emmanuel Saez for 2012 is even a little bit above 50%. It's about 51%. So the trend seems to keep going on. You know, this is a pretty big trend. So, you know, at some point, you have to take the number seriously. I think it would be a bit silly to deny, you know, this very large rise in inequality. And, you know, so some people seem to believe that, you know, wherever it goes will be okay. But, you know, at some point, you have to ask yourself, okay, this has gone from 30-35% to 50% in 30 years. You know, are we going to have 60% of total income for the top 10 in 2020, 70%, you know. the numbers are so large that it's important to really understand what's going on. So I'm not going to talk too much about this in this lecture, but let me say a few words. In the book, I report research, trying to analyze the reason for this big rise. So clearly, the inequality in access to education, in access to skills, and the evolution of the supply and demand of skills explain part of the rise in inequality in the United States over the past 30 years. But this is not sufficient, this reasoning in terms of education and skill is not sufficient to explain the huge rise at the very top. So in particular, you don't see that here, but a very big part of this rise comes really from the top 1% and the top 0.1%. And, it's not as if, these people are a lot more educated than the 1% below them or the 2% below them. So, you really have a discontinuity at the very top that is very difficult to explain on the basis of supply and demand for skills. So with Emmanuel Saez, Stephanie Stancheva, we've been putting together a database at the company level where we really try to ask, okay, why is it that some companies pay their top managers $10 million instead of one? Is it useful? Is it bringing, better performance? What do we see in the data? And, frankly, we don't see much extra performance in the data, and this seems to have mostly to do with the growing ability of a number of top managers, to put the right people in the right compensation committee so that they get the right pay increase. And I think it would be very naive. In our standard textbook model, we tend to assume that when someone is paid $10 million instead of one, it must be that his marginal product to the firm has grown from 1 to 10. I think this is an excessively naive view of how the labor market operates, at least at the very top end. It's very difficult to put a numbers on individual marginal products in a large corporations, and there's a lot of imperfect information, to say the least. And, of course, it's very tempting for top managers, to try to help, set their own pay in the most favorable way. And what we show, comparing different companies, different sectors, different countries, different time period, with Saez and Stancheva, is that probably an important part of this explanation for this big rise has been, the huge decline in top income tax rate in the U.S., which has completely changed the incentives for top managers to, try to bargain upward their compensation package. Anyway, I'd be happy to answer questions about this process later on, but by and large, what I am doing in the book and what I'm going to do in the rest of the lecture is to try to shift the attention from this important issue of rising inequality and rising inequality of income and rising top managerial compensation to the issue of wealth accumulation and the distribution of wealth. So I'm going to show you another graph which looks a little bit like this one, but which in fact is very different and which has to do with the return of very large wealth-to-income ratio. Okay? So this is a graph about Europe, and you have very much the same evolution in Japan, but the evolution is less strong for the United States. So, it looks a bit the same as the previous one, with this sort of very big U-shaped curve, this very big decline after World War I, World War II, and then this increase in the recent decades. But in fact, this is not measuring at all the same thing. This is not the same economic process. So you have different processes going on at the same time. And this is not taking place in the same areas of the world. Largely, this is European and Japan phenomenon, whereas the rise of top incomes is mostly the U.S. Well, in Britain, you have a little bit of the two. So this is an interesting juncture. But, this is... In Europe and Japan, this same U.S. Curve will be almost flat for the later part. You have an increase in the top income shares, but very moderate. For Britain, you will be in between continental Europe and the U.S. Whereas here, you can see in Britain, you have a general evolution that's very comparable to France. In Germany, the levels are below, but the trend is the same. So what do we have on this graph? This is not... Let me make very clear that this return of very large capital-to-income ratio as in principle, is very different from a rise in inequality. So all what this is saying is that the total value of capital And on this graph, this is private capital, private net wealth. So this is the total value of real estate assets, financial assets, minus financial liabilities, minus financial debt. Now, the value of everything that private households can own in the country, you know, has increased tremendously since the 1950s and 60s as a fraction of national income. So this used to be, you know, between 2 and 3 years of national income in the 1950s. This is now, you know, up to four, five, six years of national income. So there is a clear rise. And as you can see, this looks like a sort of return to the previously very high wealth-to-income ratio that we had prior to World War I. Okay? Now, this per se does not necessarily imply a rise in inequality. You know, it could be that everybody has an equal share in the capital stock. So in principle, this could go together with a perfectly egalitarian society. Now, in practice, the inequality of property, of assets, is always a lot more extreme than the inequality of labor income. So other things equal, this rise in the wealth-to-income ratio also tends to lead to a rise in total inequality, but this does not have to. Okay? Per se, there is nothing bad in the fact that we have a lot of capital relative to income. So anyway, in the rest of this presentation, you know, I'm going to talk mostly about the first 2 points and not so much about the third point. So you know, I'm going to be making 2 main points in the rest of this talk. You know, the first point is going to be about what I call here, you know, the return of a patrimonial or wealth-based society in Europe and Japan. And basically, the point is that, you know, wealth-to-income ratio seem to be returning to very high levels, particularly in low-growth countries. And you know, Europe and Japan, a big difference with the United States is that they have a much lower population growth. So remember, population growth has been a very large part of total GDP growth historically. And Europe and Japan right now are having, you know, very low or even negative, in some cases, population growth. And the basic intuition is that in a slow-growth society, you know, wealth accumulated in the past can naturally become extremely large. Okay? So, you know, of course, at some point, you know, the wealth accumulation, wealth-to-income ratio has to stop rising. So I'm not saying it's going to rise forever. It will stabilize at some point. It will stabilize somewhere. But this somewhere can be pretty high in a low-growth society. And, you know, to some extent that we will have growth slowdown everywhere at some point, in particular for population growth, this can become relevant for the entire world. Now, the second point that I will be making will be more directly about the future of wealth inequality and wealth concentration. And so here, the main point I will make is that, okay, there are many determinants of wealth inequality. It really depends on the pattern of saving behavior across income and wealth group, and it's really very difficult to predict where it will go. But there's one important force that I would like to emphasize, is that other things equal, when you have a higher R minus G differential, where R is the net of tax rate of return to capital and G is the growth rate, then wealth inequality tends to converge to very high levels. So again, it's not going to converge to infinity, but it can converge to levels which can be possibly, you know, even higher than the extreme level we observe in the 19th century. Now, this doesn't have to happen necessarily. You know, nobody knows how far this will go. But, you know, I guess one of the main points coming from this book is that, you know, we need more democratic transparencies and we need adequate democratic and fiscal institutions so that we better know how this is evolving over time and so that we can adapt our policies, in particular our tax rates, so as to democratize wealth and to have you know, more diffusion of wealth. So the point is not to reduce the wealth-to-income ratio per se, but rather to try to make sure that, you know, the share going to the middle class and lower groups in society rises rather than shrink until you know, an excessive point. Okay? So let me let me start with the first point, which is about the return of a wealth-based society. So, you know, I'm not going to spend too much time about the technicalities. Just let me tell you that, you know, in this book, you know, I define capital and wealth in a very broad way, and that's including, you know, everything we can own and that can be sold on the market, net of all debt. So this excludes human capital, except in societies where you can actually own other individuals as slaves. And you know, I talk about this in the book, and you know, I have results on these slides, which I will probably not have time to show you. Now, according to economic textbooks, the ratio of capital to output or of capital to income is supposed to be a constant. But you know, you should be careful with textbooks. You know, sometimes you know when we don't know too much in economics about something, you know, we just assume it's a constant. You know, if you have only one data point, everything is a constant. But in fact, you know, it is clear in the data we have that it's not a constant. You know, in fact, we observe both in Europe and Japan a very large recovery of what I call the beta ratio, which is the ratio between capital and income, between the total value of what we own and 1 year of national income, from, you know, 200-300% in the 1950s-60s to 500-600% today. Okay? So the key question is, you know, are we heading back to the very high level observed in the past, or even more? How can we think about this? So first, let me show you the evolution. So this is the evolution of the private beta. So this is the ratio of private capital to national income in the top eight developed economies in the world: the US, Japan, Germany, France, UK, Italy, Canada, Australia. So what you can see is two things. You know, first of all, you can see that there's a lot of chaotic movement. You know, the story of capital, as I show in my book, is always, you know, a complicated multidimensional story. So in particular, the story of real estate, the story of financial assets, the story of business assets, the story of the public debt are not the same. And when you aggregate everything, you are really aggregating very different processes, and you should always be aware of that. So in particular, when you want to explain some of the evolution, it's clear that a lot of the evolution that we have in this graph, you know, have to do with short-term movement in asset prices. So look at Japan in 1990. You know, Japan go from a wealth-to-income ratio of 500% in 1985 to 700% in 1990. Okay, even with a Japanese saving rate, you cannot accumulate wealth so fast, you know, because in order to increase your wealth by 2 years of income in 4 years, you will need to save 50% per year, you know, net of depreciation. You know, nobody does that. So here, this is clearly an example where what was happening in Japan at that time, of course, was a big rise in real estate prices and stock market prices. And then in the early 1990s, you can see that these asset prices are going down. But so in the short run and medium run, you have lots of asset price movements. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you about real estate price in London or Paris. You know, you've heard about that. So, you know, this is moving very fast, and this is clearly the dominant force. Now, in the longer run, there seems to be more than that going on, in the sense that you can see that every country was between 2 and 3 years of national income and of private wealth as measured in fraction of national income in 1970. And, you know, is between 4 and 7 years in 2010. Okay, so there's a clear pattern of evolution. And, you know, if you come with a model that tells you that it should be a constant over time, you know, you have a hard time explaining this. Now, this rise of private capital relative to GDP, you know, let me say very clearly that there's nothing bad per se. And, you know, actually, it's good to have more wealth than to have only debt. And, you know, right now in Europe, and, you know, there are lots of people who feel that, you know, we have a lot of private debt, we have a lot of public debt. Well, okay, that's right, but, you know, we also have a lot more wealth than we've ever had for many decades, okay? So in other words, you know, actually, if you can compare the two, so, you know, on this graph, I compare the rise of private wealth with the decline of public wealth. So public wealth or public capital is defined in the same way as private capital or private wealth, which is the difference between the real estate assets, the financial assets, minus the financial debt of the government sector. So you can see that this can be negative. So for instance, in Italy, this is negative, which means that, you know, according to the Bank of Italy balance sheet, you know, even if the Italian government and regional and local government were to sell all the real estate, all the financial assets they have, they will still have some public debt left. You know, they could not reimburse the entire public debt. But more generally, you can see that in every country, almost every country, you know, net public capital has been declining over time. But you can also see that the rise in private capital has been much larger than the decline in public capital. So if you take the case of Italy, you probably, I'm not sure you can read the numbers below, but you will see that, you know, in Italy, private capital rose from 240% to 680% of national income, while public capital dropped from 20 to -70%. So in other words, you know, the rise in private capital has been four times bigger than the decline of private capital. So what this is saying is that it's not a transfer from public to private hands. Well, there's been a transfer, you know, but it's only, you know, the rise, for instance, of Italian private wealth, one quarter of it corresponds to the fact that Italian households have bought the public bonds issued by the government of Italy and have sold some of the assets that were privatized by the government of Italy. Okay, so privatization of public assets, rise of public debt has been important. And you know, in some countries, this has allowed a private household to get a lot richer than simply through saving. And certainly in Britain and in France, you know, privatization, sometimes at very low prices, was a nice way to accumulate private wealth. You know, there are some other countries in Russia where this has been an even more efficient way to accumulate private wealth. And apparently some of them have even come to London to benefit from this beautiful city. But as you can see, you know, at the world level, it's more than a transfer from public to private hands. You know, the increase in private wealth has been a lot bigger than the decline in public wealth, which per se, you know, is good news, because, you know, when we are always, you know, we are always worried about the public debt, and we feel that, you know, we are going to leave more public debt to our children as a fraction of GDPs than we've ever left. Well, this is true, but, you know, we are also going to leave more private wealth as a fraction of GDPs than we've ever left for an entire century. And the increase in private wealth has been a lot bigger than, you know, the decline in public wealth. So, you know, that's important. And, you know, in Europe sometime, and in particular in my country, you know, people feel that we are being owned by, you know, the Emir of Qatar or the Bank of China or, you know, whoever, or maybe the Mars planet. But, you know, at the end of the day, not only, you know, we in Europe own ourselves, but we actually have more financial assets in the rest of the world than the rest of the world in Europe. And, you know, European countries are rich. Our governments are poor, which is a problem. But, you know, European countries as such are rich. And, you know, this is good news. I'm not going to show the much longer run evolution. Just let me give you a little bit of theory. You know, I think simple mathematics can be useful. You know, sometimes economists, I think, use too complicated mathematics, but to explain sometimes very little fact or sometimes no fact at all, which is excessive. But, you know, I think a little bit of mathematics, if it helps you to think about a lot of facts, can be useful. So here is the very little bit of mathematics I want to give you. You know, in the long run, if we forget about relative price effect, which we should never forget, you know, because real estate prices, you know, certainly don't move at the same speed as other prices, oil prices, other asset prices don't either. So, you know, that's a very simplified view of the world. But still, if we forget about these relative asset prices and we think of a one good model where, you know, we produce apples and capital is just a big pile of apples. And, you know, don't ask me why we have a big pile of apples, but, you know, that would be the simplest economic model. The simplest formula is that, you know, in the long run beta, so which is the quantity of capital you accumulate, will be equal to S divided by G. So this is saying something very simple. If your saving rate, S, is twice as large, then in the long run you will accumulate twice as much capital, which is not too surprising. What's more interesting is that if you have a lower growth rate, then in the long run you accumulate a huge pile of capital. You know, take the extreme case where G is equal to zero. If you keep saving forever, you will accumulate an infinite pile of capital. So of course you're not going to do that. At some point you will stop saving because, you know, if we all have 100 floors for ourselves, you know, the marginal value of having an extra apartment, you know, will be zero, and people will stop saving much before that. But this tends, you know, for given saving rate, you know, this tends to push the beta toward high levels. So typically, for a given saving rate of 10%, you know, if your growth rate goes from 3 to 1.5, which is typically the difference between the US and Europe, if you have zero population growth instead of 1%, 1.5% population growth, and if all what you have is the productivity growth rate of 1.5%, then you tend to accumulate much bigger quantity of capital. Okay? So that's not enough to explain everything, because, you know, again, real estate prices matter a lot, energy prices matter a lot, but this gives you, you know, a sense of, you know, how to think about the total quantity of wealth we accumulate in the long run. Now, whether this is also going to push up the capital share in GDP, you know, it's a complicated issue. You know, I'd be happy to answer questions in what follows. What we've observed, you know, in the recent past is a rise in the capital share. So this is the share of national income, the net of depreciation capital share in national income. And this has increased. So this is what I call the alpha in the book. And this has increased at the same time as the beta. Now, in the standard economic model, the simplest way to explain this would be what economists call an elasticity of substitution that's somewhat larger than one, which would correspond to a situation imagine this is corresponds to a situation where it's easier to substitute labor for capital. So, you know, the extreme case will be, you all remember this announcement that was made by Amazon at the end of last year that they were going to replace delivery workers by drones. And, you know, some people thought it was a joke, but in fact, apparently, it was not a joke. Some other people say that, you know, they are already treating their workers like drones, so maybe they should just have drones. But in any case, that will be, in the economic language, it will be sigma equal infinity. That will be an infinite elasticity of substitution. Now, in order to explain this, all what we need is an elasticity of substitution of 1.2, 1.3 instead of 1, which is the standard assumption in the so-called Cobb-Douglas production function. But, you know, there's no reason to assume that the elasticity of substitution is exactly equal to 1. And this is only, you know, this is really the only assumption where the decline in the return to capital would exactly compensate the rise in the quantity. Is this the right explanation for the rise in the capital share? I'm not saying that. You know, I think there are many other explanations for the rise in the capital share. Certainly, the declining bargaining power of labor and unions and globalization has increased the bargaining power of capital, and this has probably been an even more important factor. Also, you know, I think it's important when we think about the capital shares and capital accumulation to have a multi-sector model in mind. So, you know, real estate and the rise of the rental value going to real estate has been a big part of the rise in the capital share. So if you only have a one sector model, you know, that may not be the best model to think of. So, you know, in the future, it could be that drones and high labor capital substitution due to robots will become very important. But for the time being, you know, real estate and the energy sector are much more important capital-intensive sectors than drones. So, you know, at this stage, if we want to explain this, you should look more at the real estate sector and the energy sector. But, you know, in the future, my main point here is that very small departures from our standard assumption, so, you know, an elasticity of substitution just a little bit above one, you know, is enough to have a pretty big rise in the capital share as you accumulate more capital assets. Okay? So, you know, for a long time, we've believed in economics that this ought to be stable. You know, capital income ratio is stable, capital share is stable, but, you know, this doesn't have to be this way. Small departure, and even more so when you move to multi-sector model, can give you, you know, large changes in this supposedly constant ratio. So let me move, and I guess I should accelerate because I can see from... Let me come to the issue of wealth inequality per se. Let me say very fast that, you know, the key question, the fact that we have a lot of wealth relative to income, again, is not bad per se. The problem is that in practice, we have a level of concentration of wealth which is extremely large. So, you know, the good news is that wealth inequality today is much less extreme than what it used to be. You know, if you take a country, you know, here I give typical numbers, the top 10% of the wealth distribution used to own, you know, 90% of aggregate wealth a century ago, and now they are closer to 60 or sometimes 70%. So this means that, you know, at least, you know, you have 20-30% of the national wealth that sort of used to belong to the top 10 that now belongs to what I call in the book a patrimonial middle class, which I define in the book as the middle 40% in society, which are not in the bottom 50% and not in the top 10. And, you know, this is an enormous change, the fact that we have a broad middle class that owns a significant share of national wealth. You know, we should not... And, of course, at the top of that, there's been a huge improvement in average living standards, average income, average wealth. But in addition, there's been a diffusion of wealth, which certainly, you know, did not prevent growth from happening. You know, the kind of extreme concentration of wealth that we had in pre-World War I European societies, you know, was not particularly useful for growth. So this has been a very important change. Now, the key question is, how did it happen and will it last? And, you know, the reason why this is a concern is that in every country, you see in the recent period either a modest rise in inequality, or at least, you know, this has stopped from declining. And in some countries, in the United States, you know, I don't have the graph here, but some recent research by Saez and Zuckman confirms that, you know, there's been a rise in wealth inequality in the United States in recent decades, you know, which is a lot higher than in France or in European countries, and so that the share going to the top 10% is now back to over 70%, 75%. So it's still less than in pre-World War I society, but, you know, the direction is not going in the right way, if you wish, or at least, you know, the middle class share in national wealth seems to be declining again. It's also important to see from this graph that, you know, there was no decline in wealth concentration until World War I. And, you know, that's quite striking. In particular, my thinking about these issues have been influenced a lot by studying France around 1910, because, you know, this was a time where people in France, you know, thought that thanks to the great French Revolution, France had become a very egalitarian country, in particular as compared to Britain. You know, this was the usual comparison. And the discourse of a big part of the Republican financial and political elites in France was to say, okay, we don't need progressive taxation. And in fact, progressive income taxation in France was created just to pay for the war in the summer of 1914, but there was a big resistance to the elite to create that, much more than in Britain in many ways. And largely this was because, you know, the argument was, okay, we don't have an aristocracy anymore. We don't have a landed elite. So, you know, we are already an equal country. We don't care about redistribution. Except that, you know, in 1913, land did not matter anymore. You know, it's only in Downton Abbey that land seems to matter in 1913. But, you know, in the real world, land was less than 5% of UK national wealth in 1913, less than 5% in France. And, you know, most of it was financial assets, real estate assets, business assets, international investment, much like today. And, you know, the dynamics of wealth accumulation and wealth concentration in a republic like France and in a monarchy like Britain, you know, in the end, do not look very different. So, you know, I think, so what are these forces that determine the dynamics of wealth inequality over time? You know, so this will be, you know, this is a picture for Paris, where the concentration of wealth was particularly extreme. You know, prior to World War I, you have 70% of the wealth that's transmitted to the top 1%. And, you know, that was not, apparently, this was not really stopping. You know, nobody knows what would have happened without World War I. You know, we are not in the domain of controlled experiments. We are not going to replay the 20th century again without World War I, the creation of the income tax, etc. But, you know, apparently, this was not declining naturally. And we have the same thing in the United Kingdom, in Sweden. So this is very. So the key finding is, you know, there was no decline in wealth concentration prior to World War shock. So was the decline just due to the shocks? And apart from these shocks, what forces determine the long-run level of wealth concentration? So let me make now the last point of this lecture, which is that, you know, if you take any dynamic model of wealth accumulation, the steady-state level of wealth concentration will be an increasing function of R minus G, where R is the net of tax rate of return and G is the growth rate. And for a very long time, you know, R was a lot bigger than G simply because the growth rate was very small. And let me make clear that R bigger than G, you know, does not imply that wealth inequality will go forever. It will simply imply that initial wealth inequalities will tend to get amplified to pretty large level. But, you know, this will not go to infinity because, you know, some families will decide to, or will choose to dilapidate the wealth. Some families will have too many children. Some will have too few children. Some, you know, many things. Some will go bankrupt. Some will make huge returns. You know, you always have shocks in the wealth process that imply some mobility. But for a given structure of such shocks, you know, the steady state level of wealth inequality, if you do simple simulation, you will see that it's a very steeply rising function of this gap between R and G. Now, with growth slowdown in the future, rising tax competition to attract capital, there are reasons to believe that R minus G might rise in the future. You know, nobody can be sure about such an evolution and how far this will go. But, you know, potentially this can have very large consequences on the level of wealth inequality. So let me make, you know, two very quick points in the time I have left. The first point is that, you know, you should really, you know, some people, when we say that R is naturally bigger than G, you know, are surprised and even feel that, you know, this is not possible from a logical viewpoint. So let me make very clear that this is perfectly possible from a logical viewpoint. And in fact, there is no economic model that predicts that R should be equal to G. You know, in every economic model, R is different from G. It's usually higher. It could be smaller in some models. In history, certainly R bigger than G has been the norm. You know, for a simple reason, you know, probably the simplest way to think about this is to go back through time and, you know, to compare. So, you know, these are centuries over 2,000 years. So, of course, these are imperfect statistics. But, you know, I think the orders of magnitudes are pretty clear. During most of human history, the growth rates were very small. So, you know, until the Industrial Revolution, the growth rates were much less than 1% per year. So, of course, we don't know for sure the growth rate in the Middle Ages, but, you know, we can be sure that they were very small because otherwise, you know, if they were just 0.5% per year during 1,000 years, you know, this would imply that, you know, the living standards at the time of Christ would be much, much below subsistence levels and that the population at the time of Christ was less than 20 individuals. And, you know, we have a lot of evidence that there were more people than that. So, you know, we know for sure that the growth rate must have been, you know, less than 0.1, 0.2% per year during most of human history. And so R bigger than G was absolutely obvious in pre-industrial society. You know, it's also obvious, you know, in a way, you know, when you read a novel by Jane Austen or, you know, Balzac, you know, it's pretty obvious that everybody knows that R is bigger than G. You know, they don't say it this way. They don't say it this way, but, you know, growth rates were obviously very close to zero. You know, you could see that the society would reproduce itself every generation in an almost identical manner. You know, there was a very slow rise in population, very slow rise in productivity, but this was all happening very slowly. And the rate of return was typically 4 to 5%. So, you know, if you open any novel of Jane Austen, everybody knows that if you want an annual income of £1,000, you need a capital value of about £20,000, you know, so that 5% of 20 is going to give you £1,000 in annual income. And this is so obvious to everybody that, you know, that you don't even explain it, you don't even have to say R equals 5 or 4, because everybody knows it, because this has very deep consequences for people's life and what kind of living standards they have, what kind of, you know, who they're going to marry with. You know, this is so important, you know, this is not just a technical economics issue. And in a way, you know, R bigger than G during most of human history was the very foundation of society, because this is what allowed a group of owners of assets to live off their capital income and, you know, to do something else in life than to care about their own survival. Now, one of the messages of my book is that the modern, you know, the Industrial Revolution and modern industrial growth did not change this basic relationship as much as one might have expected. So in the sense that, you know, with the Industrial Revolution, the growth rates have increased, but, you know, they have increased to 1.5% per year. At the same time, the return to capital probably have increased a little bit, and, you know, this is difficult to measure this notion in a very precise manner, but certainly what we know for sure is that the gap between R and G was not affected that much. And I think this is one of the key reasons why, you know, the dynamics of wealth concentration in the 19th century led to a level of concentration of wealth at the eve of World War I, which at the end of the day was not very different from that in the 18th century. So the nature of assets, the nature of capital has changed completely from land to industrial and financial assets, but the level of concentration of wealth did not change that much. And, you know, in the future, so here I am just using the United Nations population projections according to which the rate of growth of population will go to zero in the 21st century. But, you know, nobody knows. You know, it could be that we are all going to have a lot of children, we are all going to make a lot of innovation, and, you know, the growth rate are going to be 4 or 5% in the future. But I think we should not bet on that. And, you know, we should, you know, I think it will be more reasonable to have, you know, another solution in case this does not happen. But, you know, we should do everything we can to promote growth. But, you know, there are reasons to believe that, you know, in the 20th century, it's really an unusual set of circumstances which brought about very large growth rate, in particular due to very large population growth rate. You know, more than half of this growth was due to population. And also the other unusual event is, you know, very large shocks to capital owners. So this is the pre-tax, pre-shock rate of return. If you bring capital destruction during World War I, World War II, Great Depression, and taxation, inflation on private bondholders, then this is what you get. You know, the after-tax, after-shock rate of return was actually very low during large part of the 20th century. And you know, this is what, you know, these very unusual circumstances that change completely the equilibrium between R and G. So, you know, I'm not saying this is the only force that will play a role. Let me just conclude with this, you know, very simple table that's, you know, using statistics that, you know, are, I should say, you know, are even more uncertain than everything I have shown you so far, which comes from Forbes magazine. Rankings of billionaires. Okay? So, you know, it's a bit sad. We live at a time where people buy a magazine to know about wealth, and, you know, I would prefer if they could read, you know, Eurostat or IMF report, but, you know, they won't find the information. So we have to do with what we have, and what we have is that, you know, if you... So usually people take this list of billionaires and they say, okay, there are more billionaires every day, but, you know, with a growing world economy, it's not too surprising that you have more billionaires today than 10 years ago. So here I do something that's just slightly more sophisticated, which is I take a fixed fraction of the world population and I look at how the average wealth of this top group, you know, at the top of the wealth ranking, so this starts in 1987 because this is when Forbes started publishing their ranking, I look at how fast they've been rising. Okay? So of course, these are not the same people over time. Okay, because some people are moving down, and you have some new billionaires, for instance, from emerging countries that are moving up. Okay? So you have some mobility of wealth, but whether you have mobility or not, you know, if you were in an equilibrium of the world distribution of wealth, you know, the average wealth of this group should be rising at the same speed as the average wealth for the entire world economy. Now, this is not what you have. As you can see, the top is rising, you know, 3 to 4 times faster than the average. Okay, so the top is rising at 6 to 7% per year in real terms, above inflation. Whereas above this period, you know, average wealth per adult has increased at 2.1%, average income at 1.4%. So it's important to note here that, you know, world GDP growth has been 3.3%, but more than half of it is population growth. So, you know, population growth is not over yet. It's going to decline in the future, but if you take, you know, the very recent period, you know, in particular due to aging, you have a lot of population growth in the world right now. So a big part of our feeling of growth in the world, you know, 3.3% per year, and this is about what we have right now, you know, in 2014, half of it, or in fact even more than half of it, comes from population. So the average income has been rising at only 1.4%, you know, in spite of China, in spite of emerging countries. Average wealth has been rising a bit faster, 2%. That's because of the rise in the beta, in the wealth-to-income ratio that I have shown you earlier. So wealth is rising a bit faster than income, but, you know, a lot less fast than the top of the distribution. So what this suggests is that, you know, we live at a time where the top of the distribution is going up, so much faster than the average. We have rising wealth concentration. You know, it's very difficult to know, again, how far it will go. I have tried my best, you know, to use other data, and let me conclude here because this might be relevant for LSE, who is certainly trying to build up its capital endowments. So this is data from university endowments in the United States. So what's good about this data is that, you know, it's a bit less passionate than the billionaire rankings, and also they are more transparent. You know, they actually publish financial statements, so you know the portfolio, and you can compute, you know, returns. You know, you don't have this information for the individual billionaire. Now, what you can see is that, you know, this kind of return, you know, this is not what you will get, you know, if you go to your bank with a £100,000 portfolio. You know, these days you're going to have a hard time, so getting that kind of return. So you can see, you know, you have about 800 universities in the US. You can see that the returns are pretty high. So these are, again, the average real annual rate of return after deduction of inflation, after deduction of administrative costs and financial fees. So at the very top, you have rate of return up to 10%. You know, at the bottom, you have 6%, which is already quite good. Now, at the top, so why do we have this? You know, one explanation probably has to do with scale economies in portfolio management. So in the case of Harvard, you know, they spend only 0.3% of their endowments in management fees, but because they have $30 billion, you know, it's already $100 million to pay for wealth managers, which is a good sum, you know, to pay for a group of wealth managers. And so if that's enough to get you a return of 10 instead of 8 or even 8 instead of 6, you know, it's worth it. So, you know, as long as this is Harvard and they are doing lots of useful things with the money and promoting science and education, you know, we are all very happy, although the poorer universities in the US may not be as happy, but, you know, it's... But if it happens at the individual level as well, you know, I think this is a clear example of what R bigger than G can mean for very large portfolio and financial endowments, and, you know, this is something we should all be concerned about, or at least, you know, we should study these dynamics of wealth more carefully. And at the end of the day, you know, this is all what this research is trying to aim for. Let me stop there.
Well, thank you very much, Thomas. We have about half an hour for some questions. What I'm going to do is can someone put the lights up or dim the spotlights, because I'll be able to see who's putting their hand up. So I'm going to collect questions in batches of three, and then we'll try and get around as many people. Can I ask you to be as brief as possible and also to say who you are before asking your question? There are roving mics. It may take just a few seconds for them to get to you. Okay, so I'm going to start down here. I'll take one from each block in the first round downstairs, and I will come to you upstairs in a moment. Yeah. So, gentleman over there.
Thank you, Tom, for that wonderful lecture. I'm an ecological economist who wants to know how you think about the whole history of capital from ecological point of view. Because you have mentioned something in your book about ecological stimulus. So I'm interested to hear from you.
Okay, I'm going to go to the middle block. Do I see a hand up there? Let's go to the back there.
Hi, Thomas. This is Harsh here. You mentioned you did a lot of research on income inequalities in different countries. During your research, which country do you think performed the best? And... in terms of income inequality, and was there any policy or historical facts that you would accord to that low income inequality in that country?
Okay, and then finally I'll take one from the left, sort of half, come down halfway. There we are, just on that row there where you are.
Hi, my name's Tony. Margaret Thatcher in the 80s, she was presented with a question, a Prime Minister's Question Time. Where she was lambasted for the increasing inequality during her administration. And in response, she said there was a dichotomy between growth and inequality, that to reduce inequality, you would suffer a reduction in growth, a reduction in efficiency, in effect. How would you respond to that?
Okay, so thanks for this very interesting question. So regarding, you know, the ecological viewpoint and natural capital, so I address these issues at the end of the book. I think this is clearly the most serious challenge that we have for the future, and you can see that there's a contradiction in the fact that, you know, growth per se can be an equalizing force in the sense that it makes wealth accumulated in the past relatively, you know, less important. So, you know, when you have high productivity growth or high population growth, that's a way to make wealth accumulated in the past less important. You know, if we all have 10 children, you know, you should not count too much on inherited wealth. But at the same time, you know, there are limits to growth. So, you know, world population has been multiplied by 10, you know, from 600 million to 7 billion today over the past 3 centuries. You know, are we going to do that again in the next 2 centuries? You know, probably not, and maybe this is not desirable. There are reasons why, you know, growth at the level we've had, at least for population in the past, you know, is not going to happen again. For per capita growth, you know, it all depends on whether we find ways, of course, to produce clean energy sources. At this stage, we don't, you know, we've not made this invention yet. So, you know, this is another reason why growth might not continue. There's no reason to be excessively pessimistic. You know, if we make the right investment right in time, this could can very well continue to have at least this kind of 1.5%, 2%, between 1% and 2% productivity growth forever, you know, assuming we invent clean energy sources. Now, the problem is that to do that, we need green investment and environmental investment in green technologies that we don't see today. And, you know, I'm a bit concerned that, at the end of the day, our problem of financial transparencies and, you know, fighting against tax havens and et cetera, are much simpler problems than global warming. So, you know, if we are not able to solve these financial problems, you know, so I think, you know, one of the main reasons for solving these financial opacity problems is to try to devote our attention to more important and more challenging questions. First of all, is global warming. Let me turn to the question about, you know, the ideal country. You know, I don't think there's any, there's a lot to learn from every country. You know, I don't want to be rude with anyone. You know, I think, when you look at the history of, the different income and wealth inequality in different countries, so of course, you find the Nordic countries, which are typically the country with the lowest level of income and wealth inequality. I guess here the main lesson that I emphasize in the book is, the main force that can push in the direction of reduction in inequality is the diffusion of skills and knowledge, and, you know, which requires, very inclusive social and educational institutions. So, you know, you want to find a way to get, you know, very large group of the population to access the highest possible skills. And you know, this is what explains the fact that the Nordic countries, despite some of, you know, recent shortcomings, you know, still have, probably are closer to, you know, kind of equal opportunity ideals than anywhere else. But, you know, I think no country, you know, look, the United States have been very good at producing, for instance, you know, very efficient top universities, but they have not been very good at getting, you know, equal access to skills. So right now, you know, I give a statistic in the book, you know, right now the average income of the parents of Harvard undergrad students, you know, corresponds to the average income of the top 2% of the U.S. distribution of family income, you know, which is a bit disturbing, because so that doesn't mean that there's nobody from below the top 2% that gets in, but this means something very precise, which is that there are sufficiently few people from below the top 2% that get in, and that the people within the top 2% are sufficiently high up in the top two, that the overall average is as if, you know, the students were picked at random within the top 2%. So, you know, I don't have the number for LSE. I'm sure it's a bit higher than that. For Sciences Po in Paris, you know, which will be one of the most elitist institutions, that will correspond to the top 10%, you know, which is a bit higher group, but still, you know, it's as if, you know, the students were picked at random. So, you know, I think there's no country, you know, has a perfect system. You know, I'm not going to defend, you know, the French university system is very badly organized, and I'm not going to say here that, you know, this is the system that other countries should adopt. You know, I think there's a lot to learn from the way the US university system and in some ways the British university system is organized, but no country has managed to reconcile, you know, efficiency with equal opportunity in a way that's satisfactory. And, you know, some countries in Europe, particularly Nordic countries and Germany, are very attached to free higher education and zero tuition fee. And, you know, certainly if you let tuition fees rise and rise forever, you know, that's not that's probably not compatible with you know, with the kind of equal access to education that we would like to have. But, you know, it's there are other ways to make the system very unequal than tuition fee. And, you know, in the case of you know, U.S. universities, there's a lot. You know, there are interesting studies showing that the financial gift that the parents make to their former universities strangely tend to coincide with the time where they have children of the age of applying. So, you know, there are other mechanisms. I think we need more transparency about, you know, educational stratification. You know, like in France, you have sometimes a lot more public money per student, you know, in the grand écoles and in the university system. So for the more advantaged students and the most disadvantaged students. So, you know, there are many different ways to create inequality. And, you know, each country has sometimes a lot of faith in its own educational model. That's certainly true in France, that's true in the US, I'm sure this is true in Britain. But sometimes this faith in our national model is not very well in line with actual evidence. And so, you know, there's a lot to learn from every country. We primarily need more research and more transparency about, you know, these important sources of inequality. Now, coming to Margaret Thatcher at the end, you know, I think there's no, I have no problem with inequality per se. You know, some inequality up to a point can indeed be good for growth and for innovation. Now, the problem is that you know, above a certain point, you know, when inequality gets too extreme, you know, it's not useful anymore for growth, and it can, in fact, become even detrimental to growth, typically because it leads to a perpetuation of inequality over time across generations that prevents mobility from happening. So, you know, we don't have mathematical formulas that determine where the tipping point is, but so we have historical evidence. So, for instance, as I mentioned earlier, you know, one important historical lesson, I think, is that the, you know, one important lesson of the 20th century is that we don't need 19th century wealth inequality to grow, you know, in the 21st century. So, you know, the kind of extreme concentration of wealth that we had prior to World War I, you know, was not useful in any meaningful way. You know, this was destroyed by World War I, World War II, and the policy that were enacted following these shocks. And, you know, this did not prevent growth from happening in the post-war period. This does not prevent growth from happening today. So we don't need to return to, you know, shrinking middle class and, you know, all the wealth going to a tiny group as we had prior to World War I. So, you know, we need to be careful about that. We cannot just believe that natural forces are going to keep inequality, you know, where it should be, which is in the common interest.
Okay, I'm going to visit the upper tier here, but I'm a bit disadvantaged with the lights, but I can see a hand up on that side. So if somebody could, there's presumably someone with a mic there, come and pass it along. Okay, yeah.
Start with the first question.
Yeah, yeah.
I realize the focus of the book is not global inequality necessarily, but I'm interested in some of what you've written about particular Africa and foreign ownership of natural resources. Thank you.
Okay, let's go up there, sort of in the towards the back. Yeah, there we go.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Piketty, for a very interesting book. I'm very curious how you reply to a criticism leveled by Nassim Taleb at your book. He has 2 points. On a factual level, measuring inequality using deciles is sort of a biased estimate because inequality, well, wealth distribution obeys a power law. And sometimes wealth is generated at the top. So that's the factual point. And the normative point would be that inequality shouldn't be the focus. What should be the focus is sort of bearing the risks of your own decision. And if you have a financial system in which you just have the benefits without bearing the risks, then this is actually the problem, not inequality.
Okay, and I'll take one from the middle block now. In the middle there.
Hi, Kieran Stopforth. My question is rising inequality, is that a problem or you know, a thing that can actually be addressed? How much of an appetite do you think the public has for really putting in place the kind of changes that would need be needed to address rising inequality?
Okay, so, you know, first of all, regarding, you know, Africa, you know, I think the biggest losers of financial opacity are, you know, the poorest countries in the world, and particularly, you know, sub-Saharan African economies, where you have a lot of foreign ownership and at the same time a lot of capital flight. And you know, in the end, we care about this only when, you know, some African you know, politician or son of politician is acquiring some real estate property in Paris and London, and then we find this really scandalous, and some wealthy people can come from Africa. But, you know, I think this is not really the way to address the problem. I think at the end of the day, the reason why we need more financial transparency and a more coordinated fight in tax haven, you know, I think this is very important, not only for developed economies and for rich countries, but also, and even more importantly, you know, for African countries and more generally for emerging countries, where, you know, it's very difficult to build, you know, confidence in the, you know, in the national tax system and in the national government. And, you know, Tim has worked a lot on, you know, constructing tax system. You know, if you don't have some feeling that, you know, the top people are paying their share. So, you know, this is a concern certainly today, you know, in rich countries, that, you know, it's difficult in Europe to ask people to make the right effort if we feel that, you know, the largest companies or the largest wealth holders don't pay tax anywhere and manage to escape the tax system everywhere. But I think it's even more so, you know, in Africa, if there is, you know, the feeling that, you know, the highest income or wealth holders, and in particular people that are related to top politicians, you know, don't pay what they should. So, you know, the issues of financial transparency and you know, coordinated registry of cross-border financial assets that I talk about in the book, I think, you know, are even more important for poor and emerging countries than they are for developed ones. Regarding the sort of the different technical ways to measure wealth inequality, you know, I think using percentile and decile is in fact, to me, is a lot more intuitive than using Gini coefficients. You know, nobody has ever seen a Gini coefficient, and, you know, I think it's easier to think in terms of the top 1%, the top 10%, the bottom 50%. You know, I think it's a much more intuitive way to represent inequality. Now, this is not at all contradictory with the fact that, you know, wealth distribution, indeed, like income distribution, tend to follow power law, but, you know, with very different exponents. You know, the problem is, you know, sometimes there's been a tendency in the history of economic thought, you know, to sort of overestimate, you know, the importance of this statistical regularity that you have Pareto or power laws. Because, in fact, you know, the coefficients of this power law are not constant, even for a given year and country, they are not exactly constant, but even more so over time, they are not constant at all. So at the end of the day, it's more power laws are more a statistical technique to try to recover the full distribution from imperfect data, typically data coming from income or wealth brackets, than really something very deep about, you know, the constancy of inequality over time and across society. And you know, Pareto had this view that, you know, inequality, you know, is stable forever, you cannot do anything about it. Well, you know, the evidence that we have clearly shows that you have large changes in inequality. You know, you have several possible futures, you have several possible levels of inequality. You know, Europe used to be a lot more unequal place than the United States of America until World War I, and now this is the opposite. So, you know, this is clear evidence that, you know, we should not have deterministic view, mechanical view of inequality dynamics. And, you know, I am much more interested in changes than in stability, because at the end of the day, you know, the world sometimes is changing, you know, much faster than what we initially imagine. And this brings me to the last question about policy change. You know, I think I'm not very impressed by those who know in advance, you know, what's going to happen and what's not going to happen. You know, I think, you know, one century ago, many people would have said that, you know, the steeply progressive income tax or inheritance tax would never happen. And then suddenly in the 1920s, 30s, you know, this became the, you know, we had very steeply progressive tax system. And, you know, sometimes the governments don't do what they have planned to do in opposition. Sometimes they didn't really have a plan, so it's even easier. And you know, things happen. You know, look, 5 years ago, everybody was saying that bank secrecy in Switzerland will be with us forever, that, you know, Switzerland was too strong for the rest of the world. And then, which I thought was always ridiculous, but anyway, you know, you had sanctions from the US government on Swiss banks, and suddenly, you know, Switzerland changed their bank law, and automatic transmission of information became possible. So, you know, of course, it's a bit sad that European countries did not do anything by their own and had to wait for the U.S. sanctions on Swiss banks to introduce some form of, you know, increased transparency in Europe. But, you know, I want to look at this episode in a more positive way, which is that, you know, if you put the right sanctions, you know, then you can get something. So, you know, you cannot just ask politely to those who benefit from financial opacity to put an end to it. And, you know, Gabriel Zucman in a recent book has done some very interesting computation trying to compute, you know, how much is the total benefit from a country like Switzerland of financial opacity? And he comes with a number that's equivalent to what Switzerland would lose from about roughly 25% tariff from Germany, France, and Italy. So, you know, this is not the atomic bomb, but this is still a pretty big sanction, you know. And you know, maybe the true number is 20% or 30%, but this gives you an order of magnitude of, you know, the benefits of financial opacity. You know, if you don't outweigh them with sanctions that are comparable to those benefits, you know, why would you change? So, you know, these kind of sanctions are not useful per se. You know, I think, you know, globalization and you know, open markets for goods, services, labor, capital are, you know, useful, and you know, globalization is a positive sum game, but, you know, if you don't have proper rules that ensure that you know, the benefits from globalization are distributed in a balanced manner, then, you know, I think there's a serious risk that, you know, more and more people turn against globalization. So, yeah, with the proper sanctions and proper political coalition, I think there are ways to change this.
Okay, we'll go along the... So I have one right in the middle, I can see there. So I'm going to go right in the middle. Someone got the roving mic? This one here? Pass it along. So into the middle, please. There you go. Okay.
Hi. I just want to ask a rather personal question. Was there an observation that prompted your research in the first place? And after this book, what is it next for your research?
Okay, I'll go to the right now. Down just here, just when the mic comes back.
Thank you very much. I'm a student from Pakistan. I would like to ask you, since this is in honor of Murashima Sensei, Could you please elaborate a bit more on your aspect of wealth accumulation and taking the case of Japan as a country which after the Meiji Restoration started accumulating wealth, and you even showed the cycle. Could you please elaborate a bit more on wealth accumulation or endowed resources with countries? Thank you. Such as US.
Okay, and I'll take a question from the left now, just down here.
Hello. Pete Comley, author and researcher about inflation. I'd like to know your view on how much you think the increasing inequality is actually related to the long-term inflation cycle, which peaks about every 200 or so years, last time in the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, and prior to that at the end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th. Both of those times saw massive increases in the money supply, and that money then went to the rich. At the same time, the poor had increasing land prices, increasing rents, commodity prices went up, their wages went down, and you ended up with things like the French Revolution. So I'd just like to know, is that another explanation? And if it is, more concerningly, in both those times, governments were running massive deficits and they tried to get that from the rich and they failed because the rich were too powerful.
Okay, Thomas.
Okay, so let me start with, you know, my personal motivation initially just came from the fact that, you know, I realized that, you know, there was all this historical data sitting there that had never been collected. So, you know, initially I started as a theorist, as Tim earlier said, and, you know, then I realized that, you know, I was proving theorems about income distribution dynamics without really knowing, you know, what facts needed to be explained, and that there was a lot of historical data on income that had never been used in a systematic manner. So, you know, I started doing it for one country, I ended up with 30 countries, and then I moved from income to wealth. But, you know, initially there was no plan, and there was no, you know, I didn't know what I was going to find, and I just thought that it would be interesting to know a lot more about inequalities and do more than simply, you know, theoretical speculation about this. You know, in the future, I think I'm partly going to extend this to more countries, in particular emerging countries. So, you know, I'm very interested in the dynamics of wealth inequality in China, which raises huge measurement issues right now, but which is a very important an issue and a growing concern in China and in a number of other emerging countries. And probably I also want to return to the study of the formation of political attitudes toward inequality and belief system about inequality, which is an issue I started working on a long time ago, which I sort of let aside during a long time because of all this historical data collection I've been doing. Japan, I think, you know, Japan is an interesting case where you can accumulate a lot of capital almost without any, you know, natural resources. So you have at least very little, natural resources certainly in terms of oil and gas and this kind of natural resources, and where the huge beta, you know, comes from the fact that, you know, you have very large saving rate, and at the end of the period, you have very low population growth. In fact, you know, even negative population growth. So, you know, you accumulate a lot of assets per capita in the country, and, you know, this is not bad per se, but this raises, you know, different issues about the policies, the tax system, which also brings me to, you know, what you can do with the tax system and what you can do with the central bank and inflation, and so, you know, inflation historically has been a very powerful mechanism to redistribute wealth. Now, the problem with inflation is that, you know, it can go in every direction. You know, sometimes it can reduce inequality, it can increase inequality. And I guess the problem, I think in the recent years, you know, we've been asking too much to central banks and creative monetary policy. You know, so of course it's much easier to print money than to change the tax code. So, you know, you can print billions of pounds or billions of euros or billions of dollars in one day. The problem is that sometimes, you know, you don't really know what you do with the money. You know, you put it somewhere, you lend it to someone, But you know, this is going to create a huge bubble somewhere. So you have very low interest rate on public bonds, but then you can have huge rates of return on other assets, and for instance, in real estate bubbles. And you know, it's not clear that this goes always in the right direction. You know, sometimes you help people to get rich, which you wouldn't like to help. So at least the tax system, it's more complicated. You need a parliament. You need people to vote on a tax base, a tax code. So that's a lot more complicated than printing money. But, at the end of the day, you have a better sense of what you're doing. So you can target, how much you ask to the different income and wealth group. You can have different tax rates for people who are, below £500,000, people who are between 500, 1 million, above 2 million. You can have a graduated tax schedule. And, I think in the recent years, we've been asking too much to creative monetary policy and too little to fiscal policy. But, it's not only, in the United States, in Britain, in the Eurozone, in Japan, pretty much everywhere. Central banks are useful institutions. Money creation is a very powerful tool. Sometimes, this is the only way, in a panic to avoid the collapse of a financial system. But in the long run, that's not going to solve our structural problem, typically inequality problem. Sometimes it can even go in the wrong direction. And, most of the time we just don't know what we're doing.
Okay, thank you. Now, before I bring matters to a close, I've been asked to ask those of you seated in the stalls to leave by the front doors of the theatre, those who are seated in the circle to exit to the rear. And Thomas will be available in the theatre, the dress circle bar, to sign copies of his book. So those of you who want to go back, come back in and form an orderly queue will be able to get his signature on your copy of Capital. But before we finish completely, I'd like to offer a vote of thanks to Thomas for a wonderful lecture, really demonstrating the